Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Emma Adjiman, personal finance writer at Investors Chronicle, and Nicholas Wall, manager of funds including Old Mutual Global Strategic Bond. Bonds have traditionally been the first area that investors have turned to when trying to diversify equity portfolios, and have also been favoured by income seekers. However, years of loose monetary policy mean that the prices of these assets are more expensive, so they do not necessarily offer very high yields and may not offer much more reward for taking on higher risks than you would get from cash. Nick, you run free bond funds. Can you explain in a bit more detail exactly what effect central bank policy has had on bonds?
Yeah, I mean, central bank policy has had a bigger and bigger impact on bonds in recent years as we've kind of hit the lower bound on interest rates and QE's become more of a factor. I mean, historically, in terms of what influenced bonds and what influenced interest rates, it was much more the kind of supply and demand for capital in the markets. You'd have people who are saving and people who borrow, and you find the equilibrium rate. And, you know, central banks would fine-tune the economy, and they might lower interest rates if they thought they wanted to stimulate demand, or raise interest rates if they, you know, they thought demand was too strong and they thought it might be inflationary. In recent years, it's gone more from fine-tuning to being a bit more dramatic. You know, when we had the crisis in 2008, bonds quite rapidly hit the zero bound, and they didn't want to take interest rates below that. So central banks engaged in QE and had a much greater effect on interest rates further out the curve, so in longer maturity bonds. And it was a much bigger influence than it was historically.
You mentioned longer maturity bonds, so I have to ask, has this affected all bonds? Because it's not like they are one homogenous thing, there's all sorts of bonds.
Again, historically, the longer dated bonds would much more be determined by the supply and demand in the market, and the central bank would traditionally influence the front end of the curve. But what you've had with QE is you've had central bank buying vast quantity of government debt, and sometimes corporate debt, and sometimes mortgage-backed securities, all across the curve in short-dated bonds and long-dated bonds. And this has had an impression that has flattened the curve and has seen interest rates in the longer end of the curve kind of come down, and had a big influence there.
Okay, now on the subject of monetary policy, it's expected, even though there wasn't one yesterday, that there might be interest rate rises in the UK this year and probably more likely in the US. So what will be the effects on bonds if these do happen?
Well, a lot of it is already priced in. So if the message from the central banks has been well communicated and they're very clear about, you know, what they're looking for in the data and what they're looking for in inflation, then when a central bank does hike or cut interest rates, then that should be priced in most of the time. And central banks try not to shock the market too much and try and give clear signposts. Now, I think you saw yesterday after the Bank of England announced that it wasn't moving on interest rates and it was quite happy with kind of where interest rates were at the moment, you saw a rally in gilts and gilt, you know, gilt bonds increase in price and went down in yield. And in the US, actually, we think that, you know, a lot of the expected hikes from the Federal Reserve this year are already priced into the curve, and the market's fully expecting them. So when the strategy from the central banks is marked very clearly, it shouldn't influence bonds too much on the actual day of any hiking announcement.
That said, bonds of shorter durations are supposed to be less affected by rate rises. Why is this? And are you investing in bonds of shorter durations?
A bond, in essence, is just a series of cash flows that an investor will receive over time.
Basically a loan, isn't it?
Yeah. So they'll receive coupons.
Which are like interest.
Exactly. And then they'll receive their principal back at the end. And to work out the value of a bond, you have to discount the value of those cash flows back into today's money. And you discount that using the prevailing interest rate at the time that's appropriate. So if you've got a shorter duration bond, there are fewer cash flows. You might have a coupon and your principal paid back. And so therefore, you know, in 1 year, whether the interest rate is 2% or 3%, it's not going to make a huge difference to the price of the bonds and what it's worth to you today. Whereas if you have a long-dated bond, say a 50-year bond or a 100-year bond that you even get these days, that's a huge amount of cash flows you'll receive. You know, you receive many coupons and you receive the principal back, and you have to discount all those cash flows back into today's money. And so therefore, like, when you have a longer duration bond with plenty of cash flows, you know, even a small change in the interest rate and the rate you're discounting those cash flows back can make a huge difference to your income. So a longer duration bond is much more sensitive to interest rate rises. And so as a bond investor, you know, you take a view on where interest rates are going and at what rate you should be discounting those cash flows back. If you thought as a bond investor that interest rates were going to fall, you'd want to buy long duration bonds and increase the duration in your portfolio. But recently, people have taken a different view and they think we're in a rising interest rate environment because, you know, we're past the kind of crisis years and we're starting to see some signs of inflation coming back. So bond portfolio managers wanted to decrease the amount of duration in their portfolio so they're less sensitive to interest rate rises. And that is something that we did do. It's, you know, since we've been managing the Global Strategic Bond Fund, we have been running short duration positions on the back of this and we've caught a lot of that sell-off. But we think now probably the situation is a bit more nuanced.
What's the average duration of holdings in old mutual global strategic bonds?
So global strategic bonds, you know, it's there for investors to have exposure to fixed income. We benchmark it, you know, against the bond index. So there will always be some duration in that portfolio and it will always be exposed to interest rate risk. But we, you know, we run less duration than our benchmark. So there's about 6 years of duration in there. Because of our view on bonds and we thought that interest rates were going to rise when we joined Old Mutual, we also launched a absolute return bond fund as well. And in that has the ability to go long or short duration in an absolute sense. And in that fund, we're running a duration position which is absolute short of about half a year.
Do bonds face any other risks?
Yeah, there are plenty of risks invested in bonds. And you can, as you go further kind of up the risk spectrum in terms of the type of bonds you buy, you get exposed to more risks. You know, for a government bond, the yield will be determined by kind of central bank expectations where people expect central banks to have rates now and in the future, like over the life of the bond. And you'll also have some inflation premium. And so, you know, inflation is very bad for bonds. Bonds pay you typically a fixed rate of interest. As inflation rises, the value of those cash flows will be lower because if inflation is at 10% and you're receiving, you know, £2 in income a year, then that's going to devalue. So you're exposed to inflation risk with bonds. But, you know, the best environment for bonds is a low inflation or deflationary environment. Also, if you decide you want to take on a little bit more credit risk, then you will have credit premium in there as well. So obviously, if you lend money to the government, that's typically determined to be the risk-free rate. But if you lend money to a corporate who has a lower credit rating, then you should be compensated for that. So you're exposed to those credit risk premium. If we went into recession, that credit risk premium rises and the value of your bond will drop. And plenty of other risks as well, such as, you know, liquidity risk, or if you decide to invest in foreign bonds, then if you don't hedge it, you'll be exposed to FX risk. So there are plenty of risks for an investor to consider. And if the risk in those bonds falls, you'll make money. And if it rises, then those bonds will drop in value relative to a safe kind of government bond.
Yeah, fair to say that a lot of what you outlined just now aren't like things specific to the moment. Those are just general ongoing risks.
Exactly. Yeah. When I'm invested in bonds for a global strategic bond or for the strategic absolute return fund, I mean, we take a view on all these risks. You know, we don't avoid risks. We judge whether, you know, in risk adjusted terms, whether it's a good investment. So if you look recently when we've been in a stronger dollar environment and US yields have been rising and, you know, a lot of the market was long emerging market debt, and emerging market debt historically has struggled in a stronger dollar environment because they borrow a lot in dollars, so their liabilities increase. And also when US interest rates rise because they tend to be the benchmark for global bonds. So you've seen a big increase in the risk premium that is demanded from investors when investing in emerging market debt. Now, we might take the view that actually that's gone too far and actually you're fairly rewarded for investing there, and take a view in that risk premium for emerging market debt should fall and invest in emerging market bonds.
Do you think that investors have overreacted to, let's say, some of the current bond risks that we were discussing before?
I don't think they have. I mean, we've shared the view with a lot of the market and a lot of other funds out there that, you know, in kind of mid 2016, when this kind of secular stagnation theory, i.e., we're in a low growth, low inflation world because we're highly indebted and because of demographics, was, you know, it's a prevalent thing driving the market. You know, the real yields, the yields adjusted for inflation in many government bonds were far too low in our opinion, and they did look overvalued. And, you know, we subsequently took short positions in there. And I think, you know, because historically bonds and yields have been a lot higher, that the sentiment is justified. But I would also caution that, you know, bonds have sold off quite a long way now. We've got US Treasury yields in the 10-year part of the curve at 3%, and they really struggled to go beyond that. So I don't think we're going to get, we won't get back to, in my view, bond yields that prevailed pre-crisis. I think, you know, the world has a lot more debt. There's still global imbalances out there where there's too many savers and a lot of borrowers. And as interest rates rise and people have borrowed, their debt service costs will go up more quickly because there's greater debt than they would have previously. So I don't think yields will get back to pre-crisis levels. And yeah, in some markets, yields are starting to look enticing to kind of close that short position and go long in some markets.
Of any particular market?
Well, I think we've had the sell-off in emerging market debt, which I think has gone too far. I think there are some countries which have strong fundamentals but have been caught up in, you know, people were too long and positioning got caught out, and the liquidity wasn't there because too many people tried to sell at the same time. I think that's, you know, we've now created value, and I think investors who step into some of the emerging markets that have the strong fundamentals will be rewarded and should do well over time. I also think, you know, as a near-term trade, maybe not long-term, but US Treasury yields at 3%, they've really struggled to get beyond there. Every time they've got to around 3%, you've seen consistent buying from many investors out in Asia who see that as an attractive level. You've also got investors also have a big short position in that market, which, you know, means that it means that a lot of people are already in the trade, and the danger is if you do get some weaker data, people might rush to close that short position and could see treasuries rally from there. So I think it's not, to us, it's not the clear-cut trade it was in late 2016. It will be a bit more two-way from here, I think.
Now, what are you doing to mitigate the various risk bonds face at the moment? I mean, you mentioned you had an IT duration, but I wondered if you're doing anything else.
So, yeah, I mean, there are bonds that we can invest in that would typically be, I mean, less exposed to movements in interest rates. I mean, one is, like you said, we can go short duration, and we can go short versus the benchmark, or in the absolute return fund, we can go outright short. So we can mitigate the risk there by using that strategy. We've also had a view that inflation would rise relative to market expectations, so we can invest in inflation-linked bonds. Also, we've been investing in the bonds of financials. Now, typically, in a rising rate environment and when the yield curve steepens at the front end, this is a good environment for banks because they typically take in deposits and, you know, will pay the central bank base rate or slightly above, and they can lend further out the curve at a longer maturities. So the bigger that spread is between where they lend and where they borrow money from depositors, the more profitable they are. So we think that's a good hedge there. And also, like I said, we like investing in emerging markets, which, you know, we think they've already adjusted to this higher interest rate environment and do offer some value here.
Okay. Now, you use derivatives as well in the funds you run. I mean, what do you use them for and in what situation?
Yeah, I don't think people should look at derivatives necessarily and think, oh my God, they're taking huge amounts of leverage. They're a way sometimes of expressing a view which might offer greater liquidity and is cheaper to do rather than investing in say cash bonds. So we use them for relative value trades a lot of the time. So we might be long a future in US Treasuries and short a future in bunds, and so it's just a cheap way for it to express that. Also, derivatives have, you know, since we've moved to central clearing in a lot of OTC markets, the kind of counterparty risk has been lowered a lot. So, you know, we don't see it as meaningfully adding to the risk of the funds, and we generally use derivatives just as a cheaper way to express a view.
Now, derivatives, I mean, you mentioned risk, they're obviously helpful, but they do incur risk. So what sort of risks do you incur when you're using derivatives?
The most obvious risk would be if you were doing a derivative which is kind of over-the-counter and wasn't transacted through a central clearer. This still happens sometimes in interest rate swaps or instruments like that. Now, the risk you are exposed to there is, you know, for example, like in the global financial crisis, you might have had the long interest rate exposure through a swap, but you're also taking counterparty risks there. And you saw the swap spreads, which is the spread between interest rate swaps and government bonds, widen significantly. So you might have had the right view, but because of your counterparty risk, you might have been facing a Lehman Brothers, for example. You're unsure whether they're going to pay out on the money you've made from your interest rate swap. So that would be the biggest risk, and that's driven the move to kind of central clearing. You can also, I suppose, because you can use derivatives sometimes and they offer a lot more liquidity, then if there is a negative event in a future you hold, then perhaps that will have, you know, a more volatile move than, say, other bonds that surround it. So a good example, this hasn't happened for a while because volatility has gone down a lot, but would be during the European crisis with Italy. Now, Italy has a very liquid interest rate future that's traded through Eurex, which offers you exposure to 10-year duration in Italy. Now, if there was a negative event in Italy, like there has been recently, although the volatility around it hasn't been too bad, then the first, the most kind of active investors in the market, typically kind of fast money in the hedge fund community, will typically sell that interest rate future. And so you might see the 10-year underperform. So you do have, in times of stress, perhaps high volatility risks if you invest in the futures, but generally they're a lot safer than they were pre-crisis.
Okay, now talking of eliminating risks, are there any areas of the bond market that you're totally avoiding?
Yeah, so we actually don't like gilts at all at the moment.
UK government bonds.
UK government bonds. And now, that's not because we think the UK is a huge credit risk at all. It's not. I mean, it's a sovereign country. It prints its own currency. And, you know, there's very, very small chance of default. It's a risk-free bond. But we just think, we look at things in terms of price, and we look at the real yield you get offered on UK government bonds, which is negative. So, you know, in inflation-adjusted terms, you don't really make any money, and it's a safe haven. And there have been a lot of kind of price-incentive buying that's gone in gilts because perhaps people use it as a hedge against Brexit and risk off, or perhaps it's pension funds that just want to de-risk their pensions regardless of the cost of gilts. So it's not a market that kind of we think that offers value to a kind of more active bond investor. We also like to avoid US investment grade credit. We think the spreads there are quite tight. You don't really get rewarded for the credit risk you're taking on. And also what you've seen in this kind of post-QE world, particularly from Japanese investors, where the Bank of Japan has been pretty much is the only player almost left in the JGB market, the Japanese government bond market. And so you've seen a huge kind of capital exported from Japan into the US market. And the Japanese investors wanted a little pickup in yield over and above US treasuries. So they've been huge investors in US investment grade credit. Now, our view is that those QE operations in Japan are slowly coming to an end. And we think a lot of that money that's gone into the US, particularly because Japanese investor went hedging for that, gets penalized for investing in the US now. And we think that money will come back to Japan and it will leave the USIG market. So technically speaking, we think that market will weaken.
Okay. Now, many financial advisors at the moment say that if you're going to invest in bonds, the best thing to do is get a strategic bond fund. Now, you run a strategic bond fund, but you also run two other types of bond funds. So what's your view on this? Are strategic bond funds best?
Yeah, I mean, we run a strategic bond fund for people. The Global Strategic Bond Fund is for people that want some interest rate exposure, and they want to fulfill a fixed income allocation in their overall portfolio. And then we run an absolute return fund, which was people who, try and create alpha over and above our benchmark, and if people don't want the interest rate exposure, they go into our absolute return fund. Now, we think strategic bond funds, whether they're absolute return or whether they have duration, are the best option. We invest across the entire fixed income and currency universe, whether it's developed markets, emerging markets, in credit, and we also take FX risk, which means, you know, we think there are always opportunities on the long and the short side to try and create alpha. We're unconstrained, and we can go into different parts of the market. We're not obliged to pay a certain level of income, or we're not obliged to have a certain allocation to a particular market, which means, you know, we can be flexible and go to the areas where we have highest conviction, where we think that there's maximum opportunity.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that in terms of areas you quite like for emerging market debt, looked interesting. What I wondered was high-yield bonds. They obviously offer a nice income and probably still quite high even if interest rates rise. So are they a good option at the moment as well?
We're a bit cautious on high-yield. I mean, I think emerging markets have seen the sell-off and they have seen more value created, whereas actually developed market risk in high-yield bonds, it hasn't been quite as bad. We like certain bonds, but we wouldn't be overweight that as an asset class because we think this kind of quantitative tightening that's going on, which is the kind of opposite effect of QE, as the Federal Reserve is already reducing the size of its balance sheet, and we'd expect the European Central Bank to kind of come to an end on its purchases by December, in our view. And this has had a huge impact on developed market risk and developed market spreads. Now, okay, the ECB and the Fed haven't bought high-yield bonds, but it's had an effect where investment-grade yields have been squeezed so tightly that people who want the yield and people who have been chasing yields in this QE environment have bought high-yield bonds as well. And they've moved up the kind of the credit spectrum. And we think as IG investment-grade yields start to look more appealing, people move out of the asset class. So we'd much rather be in emerging market bonds versus high-yield at this stage.
Okay. Now, just more generally, how do yields on bonds compare to other income assets at the moment? For example, equity income, which is something lots of people turn to, or perhaps even commercial property.
Yeah. One thing we're careful when we're pitching our funds and when we're, you know, trying to extol the benefits of them is that, you know, income is only one part of the total return in our portfolios, and we don't buy yield or buy carry just for the sake of it. We take a view on it. We're not targeting income. So at the moment, gilt yields, you know, they're not for you much. They offer, say, like slightly less than 1.5%, and the dividend yield in UK equities and in commercial property for the most part is higher. But you are taking the risk that your income may be higher, but your capital may be lower if we get a risk averse environment, or if commercial property in the UK decreases in value because of things like Amazon and decline in the high street presence. So your income will be less in UK government bonds, but you generally tend to be a better store of value, and capital preservation tends to be higher.
I mean, on that note, would you say that bonds are higher or lower risk than equity income, commercial property at the moment?
I would say that they are lower risk. I mean, they're designed to try not to be too exciting, and you're not really, you expect, you might lose money in real terms if you adjust for inflation, but you'd expect to be repaid your principal. Whereas as an equity investor, you're exposed to a lot more risk. You're exposed to, yeah, to growth in the economy, or you're exposed to, you know, the risks that company that you invest in have. So, you know, gilts tend to be a safe haven play. They tend to be what people turn to in times of high volatility. But that's why they kind of offer you less yield.
Okay. Now, turning to the fund, Old Mutual Global Strategic Bond, you've been running it for nearly 2 years, so not that long. Have you made any changes since taking it over?
Yeah, so Mark Nash and I, we've been managing, like you say, managing the fund for nearly 2 years. We have made changes. We have come from more of a kind of institutional background, so we are very much process-driven. And we've introduced a kind of a much more rigid risk framework in which we make our decisions, and so the volatility of the fund has gone down a lot. We've also increased the kind of spectrum of what it can invest in, and trying to capture opportunities from across the fixed income spectrum. I think we've also, one thing we've tried to do is try and increase the transparency of the fund as well. So I think investors trust you with their money, and they expect you to take risk with it, but they want to know what's going on in their fund, and they don't want any surprises. So, we've been very clear each month. When we write a monthly commentary, we'll send an example of a model portfolio and show where the risks have been taken. So that means that even if an investor doesn't like what we're doing, at least they can kind of hedge against it, and they know, where the gains and losses are coming from.
Have the changes you've implemented improved the fund's performance?
Yeah, I mean, they have. I think our two-year track record is top quartile in our peer group now. And
that wasn't the case before, was it?
That was not the case. Yeah. And the volatility has gone down a lot. It was a very high conviction funds, which is fine, but it typically had high volatility. We've introduced a much tighter risk framework, and risk adjusted returns versus our benchmark have gone up quite a bit and now looking good versus peers.
Okay. Now, one thing I notice about the old mutual global strategic bond, it seems to be doing well in its total returns, but it actually has a lower yield than many of its global bond sector peers. I mean, I looked yesterday, for example, the 12-month yield was 1.66%. Why is this?
Yeah, and this comes back to a point I made earlier, is that the yields you get from a fund is only one part of the total return. And having a low yield is a conscious investment decision. It means that we don't go chasing carry and yield in markets that we think are overvalued just to get that yield up. Now, we'd much rather wait for the opportunities to present themselves like that they have done in emerging markets in the last couple of weeks. And so if we'd have chased that yield and got the yield up in a fund, which made them aesthetically might have looked more appealing to someone, looking at the total return level, you'd have got carried out when emerging market bonds sold off. So we have a view that as central banks unwind their quantitative easing programs and as growth and inflation picks up, yields should return, the extra spread you get on corporate bonds and emerging markets will return to more normal levels, and then we'd look to buy it, then you'll see an increase in the yield. But at the moment, we don't see that many opportunities there, so we choose to keep the yield low and concentrate on capital preservation and building total returns that way versus our peers.
Okay, so just, I suppose, on a scale or whatever, on a balance, how important is total return versus a yield just generally for yourself?
So total return is pretty much everything for us. I think, if you're looking for consistent income, there are plenty of, we have one within our team with a monthly income bond fund, which, targets a certain amount of income each month. Whereas we are looking for total returns and carry or the yield is part of the equation. Of course, it can make up a sizable part of that return, but we won't just boost that when we think that the yield enhancing products just don't offer that much value and you aren't compensated for the risk. And it comes back to the point you made earlier about what other risks do bond market investors have, and credit spread is a huge part of that risk, as is the spread you should be compensated for by going down the credit spectrum and investing in emerging market bonds. And if we judge that spread is too tight and too narrow, then you will see the yield in our fund come down, and we'll wait for opportunities to present themselves and for them to look better value than a lot of them do today.
Okay, thank you, Nick. A really helpful explanation of the workings of the bond market and how you run your funds. If you do things on the cheap, you might not get the best outcome, and it seems that this is certainly the case with funds. A recent study of UK all-company sectors funds has found that the top-performing ones aren't necessarily the cheapest. Emma, you've been looking at this. How did the study come to this finding?
Well, Leonora, Chelsea Financial Services looked at the performance of 238 funds in the Investment Association UK all-company sector, and they looked at that performance over 5 years. And they found that 4 out of the top 10 performers had an ongoing charge of more than 1%, which is actually quite a high level of fees for a fund. So it's this point that you're saying that actually the top performing funds are not necessarily the cheapest ones.
Okay, so which was the top performing UK all companies sector fund over 5 years?
It was Old Mutual UK Dynamic Equity, which returned 122.3% over 5 years, and that's after charges. And that fund has an ongoing charge of 1.07%.
Okay, so which other funds did well?
The fund to come second was CFP SDL UK Buffetology, and it made similar levels, 121.7% after fees. It has an ongoing charge of 1.28%. And another Old Mutual fund made the top 10, Old Mutual equity came fourth, and it made a return of 114.2% after fees over 5 years, and it has an ongoing charge of 1.1%.
Okay, so let's say at the other end of the scale, how did the cheapest funds do?
Well, perhaps not surprisingly, the cheapest funds were all trackers. iShares UK Equity Index, HSBC FTSE All Share Index and Fidelity Index UK. They all had the same ongoing charge figure of 0.06%. And they also roughly made the same return over 5 years, 36%. As we were talking about earlier, they were massively outperformed by those top four funds, which, even with their higher charges, outperformed the cheapest funds by between 155% and 238%.
It's quite a big outperformance. So is it the case then, the more you pay, the better the performance?
Unfortunately, no. It's not that simple, because of all, you know, Chelsea found that there were lots of funds with very good performance that had higher fees. It also found that there were more than half of the funds in the bottom quartile of performance that had higher fees of 1% or more.
Okay, so what would be an example of a poorly performing fund with a high charge?
One example was TC Dalmore Growth and Income, and it has an ongoing charge of almost 3%, which was actually the highest ongoing charge of the fund surveyed. But even compared to the passives, which made 36% over 5 years, this fund made 22% over 5 years after fees. And in terms of performance of the 238 funds that were looked at, it ranked 223 out of, 238.
OK, I suppose this begs the question, though. So what do you do? Do you buy or do you avoid funds of higher charges?
I mean, it's definitely, it's the key thing to think about. The analyst I spoke to said that it's very important to actually monitor an active manager's performance carefully. And actually, you need to think about performance in relation to fees. So it's how much the fund actually delivers after the fees, rather than just, a high or low ongoing charge that they have. So yes, make sure you look at that, and also make sure that you monitor the performance. Obviously, short-term performance or underperformance can kind of affect every manager. But if a fund has been consistently underperforming for 3 years, then that could be a sign that, you really need to think twice.
Okay, thank you, Emma. Some really helpful tips on how to assess fund charges. That's all we've got time for today, but you can read Emma's full report on fund charges and more on the prospects of fixed income in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle on the website. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.